Okay, so thanks, Tony Allen and Alan Eagle, for this keynote speech. I guess if you have a lot of questions, I'd have to would like to address the speakers directly. But we are a bit behind the schedule. I think it's around 11, 10 past 11, and we should start the sessions. And Alan Eagle will be leading the session upstairs about water supply and sanitation. So if you have some questions, and Tony Allen will be in this room sharing the session about short boundary water qualities, and there will be a lot about issues that come out of the conversation. So very quickly, 5 minutes for them, 5 minutes, 2 minutes for us, 5 minutes for us, the two of us to say which is the goal of this conference and what we will achieve at the end of the day. What's tomorrow?
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry that we don't have some time to address some questions to these interesting and intelligent speakers. The main objective here is to discuss the associated program, a lot of very complex issues towards Africa and water, and learning from the experience of African countries, and learning also from our experience in Europe. Talking to myself, I am here mainly to learn from African colleagues. I think that some of the main issues were already mentioned. Access to water is maybe the main concern of everybody in this room, and it was mentioned several times, and it is mentioned in several communications. And I think we are mainly trying to discuss in these 2 days what are the curtains between this final goal aim and the institutional systems that are working in Africa, how these adaptation systems are, how these systems are more adaptable, more flexible, more less flexible, how is this vulnerability more serious in African countries, how the regulation system and the political system, how is working, the transparency, the accountability, and the dialogues between or among all the users of water. And I think that is the main goal of this conference, to learn somehow to think about African countries and about all countries in the world, because this is something that we are trying to solve and not to be successful.
So I would just like that all of you keep in mind how this conference started, because all of you have sent a proposal for debating one issue, that is water in Africa, water management in Africa, hydro pessimism, hydro optimism, or hydro peso optimism, or the other way around, peso. Okay. So I mean, at the end of today, tomorrow there will be a final debate, and I would like that. Do we have a clear idea? Can we be optimist and pessimist at the same time? Can we have a strong position saying that we are pessimist about the situation right now, that we are optimist about the future? Because I remind the questions were, which are the challenge, and we have plenty of replies for this, but which were the solutions that were already issued? Because something had been done already, wrong or right, by the donors, by the political people, by the fucking strategies, by the population themselves. So let's look at the cases as they are and not just talk about what can be and so on and so forth. So I would ask every of you that in your sessions also take notes, and then tomorrow afternoon we will find a solution for the problem. So what are we? So, and I will not take more time. You have a problem with you, and we can, so let's say that this is the room number one, so because the numbers are a bit different, but this is the room number one, so you have a problem in the first page, and the room number two is just upstairs, so we can communicate, and people can move in the rooms, but please don't do that very often, because that is a bit disturbing for the people presenting. Just another small detail, this conference is being recorded in audio files. The idea is that the outcomes of this conference are not just here in this nice room, this nice garden, but that we need to communicate with the outside world. And I mean, we are talking here is also to reach a major audience. So the idea is to have this as a hybrid class. So basically, it will be online. Although, if any of you has any problems with this, just tell me, and we can stop the record, the audio record. Sorry, yeah, I should have asked. And but anyway, if you don't know, of course, that it's not going to be published. So okay, thank you very much. There is a small coffee break, I suppose. We can do some questions because the panel was supposed to start at 11, so it's only that we have a little to run in brief, and we'll have the lunch in later. Okay, so then, okay. It's what?
It's 10 past 10.
It's 10 past 10? Oh, that was 10 past 11.
No, it was
10 past 11. Okay, so there was no rush. So in that case, is there a microphone? Okay, very well. First question, burning questions. Who's the first one? Maybe we need a coffee first?
I have a good question.
Yes, question. Yeah, a little question.
My name is Persko. I am not an engineer, but I'm a socialist. I have no question, but it seems that you were saying now is for me, in my view of animals, I must say that water in Africa is expensive, but is more unpredictable. Because farmers, when some person says, I have water for you, the farmer may be questioned. The first question is, when you have the water, not the water. Because I think water in nature is relational to the subject. So the question is not maybe how many more. But when and what can I do with this water? So this is my way of thinking.
So we can take two, three questions.
Can I just clarify that question? When we talk about water, we will be talking about big water, that is the water that we need to grow food, which is 90% of the water that each of us needs or a nation needs. Or even which tends to be rather low quality water, and everyone expects it to be free, because in nature it's free, and if governments provide it, people think it should be free as well. And then there's the small water, which can be extraordinarily high value, as we've seen from our store, and that's just 10% of the water that we need. And most of before industrialization, we scarcely used any water because we didn't use to wash. So, the arrival of the perception of high value water to keep us clean in our homes is a fairly recent experience. So I think you were talking about reliability of water. Were you talking about reliability of water for irrigation? Or were you talking about reliability of water in the sense that Alan was talking about in domestic and industrial or work circumstances? Which one is it? Is it one or both?
Do you want to reply to the question? So, were you talking about big water, small water, water supply?
Yes, small water.
This is just a clarification.
The problem is that the problem is with the water, I can make money. That's a good truth. And so, we don't have solution. We and researchers don't have solution. Solution is inside of society. It's auto-organized. And so we can make or give some different point of view. And for Africa, the question is how make the market? If the farmers are rich, if the farmers have some money for spend with the community. So they have the solution. And small portions of water is valuable. Everything in the economic, in the African economic, literally, is too much. And it's a question of time. I have the water. So when I have this, it's very good. And so it's a revolution because I think is this a crisis of water and a water of crisis in Africa? So these two subjects, different subjects. So it's the revolution in nature of the water in Africa.
I think I can respond. I think I get what you're saying. I think the problem is not the resource itself, where it is or how it's behaving, but it's the capacity to utilise what you have and, you know, to bring your skills, your knowledge, etc., assets to bear on that resource to create a livelihood or derive income, which I think is really, you know, fundamentally about the issue of adaptation and adaptive capacity, or adaptive management. It's true that there are parameters, there are limits. The Ethiopia's water system fails, and this year it did fail. Things happen to the resource. The cost of water, the actual market, and there is a market, increases enormously. So one of those 20 liter jerrycans could rise to $1, and it did in some places in southern Ethiopia, just for a short period of time. But that was because so many farmers needed it for their livestock, not for their own personal, they needed it to keep their bank accounts alive. So, you know, there are issues there about how the resource behaves and how the resource is valued according to its availability or scarcity, which has a bearing on what people can do with it because it becomes very expensive and costly. So I think I agree with what you're saying, but there's also a resource availability value argument, which is very important.
I would just like you to introduce yourself before, because we don't know, we still don't know each other, so my institution. So if we get to the question here from Bobby.
Yeah.
Kat is afterwards. There's a
microphone. My name is Godwin Ojo. I'm from Nigeria. I'm also a student of King's College, London. I'm interested in the way some of the solutions have been proposed, talking about changing lifestyles, and in particular talking about changing our dietary patterns. In Africa, most people dwell in rural areas, and some of them are vegetarians by force, not by right, because they have no means to make their protein eat. This is essentially because they depend on the forest to provide their meat and their resources. So I'm trying to look at the statistics that are available and to say that some of the food needs and indeed meat come from the forest, and that still represents a great percentage of people in rural areas. So in other words, free range is really free range, not as we have it in enclosures in Europe. So I'm really looking at that to see how it affects the confidence of the statistics we have and how that affects the water level and the water needs of the people.
I presume that question is for me. I'm not at any point suggesting Africa should consider going vegetarian.
I'm concerned. I want to.
I'm concerned that people in the north should become vegetarian because they have diets which are very unhealthy. And the lack of option on the part of the people in Africa is very serious. And livestock rearing is for. And you saw from that satellite picture, there are lots of marginal areas in Africa, marginal in terms of rainfall, where the only economic activity that could possibly be is livestock rearing. We've had a thesis done recently by Yasser Nouradine on Sudan, and he looked at the water resources of Darfur, which are, as everyone knows, not rich rural lands, they're very semi-arid grazing areas. But the huge livestock production of Darfur, not at the moment, but in normal circumstances, is spectacular. He's calculated that there's more water goes through the animals in Darfur, which then why the water are sent to Khartoum or Saudi Arabia or other places, than is the allocation of the Nile water to Sudan. That's 18.5 cubic kilometers. He's calculated that the water content, or the water embedded in the livestock, which is exported, is greater than that. So I'm sort of amazing in different ways of counting water, which are actually fundamental, but no one takes into account. And I'm not saying that the people of Darfur should be vegetarian or any Bangladesh, but we should take into account other water sources where it is absolutely rational to use them for livestock living. And we should also look at other areas of Africa where, with improved infrastructure, it is going to be better, possibly get a much better return to water than we did at the moment. The other thing about productivity of water, which we'll talk about in the next session of this room, is that the rain-fed farming is also involved in water use, but no one has taken into account. The majority of water in the world, and the vast majority of the water in Africa, isn't the water that we tap, not the taps of Ethiopia, it's the water in the soil that raises food. And unfortunately, the level of productivity in these rain-fed areas is very low. And I wish there was someone from Ethiopia, because I'm in constant conflict with Ethiopia. The land and water people there insist that it isn't possible to improve the productivity of the African rain-fed areas in the Sahara and the slightly higher rainfall areas in Sudan and in Ethiopia and in Uganda and so on, from the half ton per hectare, which is very common to yield level of production in parts of Ethiopia, to something more like international levels of productivity in those sorts of areas. FAO argues that the soils are so awful and the rainfall so unreliable that a half a ton a hectare is all enough to be good. There is other evidence. I was looking at a study by the World Bank which indicated that it's true that in many areas the productivity is very low, but something called the yield gap, that what is possible to get from a farm which is extremely well run, and the farms that are actually existing in this particular fact of Africa, where the production very greatly, and it's found that near the other area, the level of the yield gap, and this is the potential yield that is being gained from the farm by the farms near the other area, 48%. If you went 100 kilometers away, where the circumstances of rainfall and land are the same, the level of the yield gap was only 6%. So 6% was achieved here, 48% here. So this is the story. Whereas the land and water sources in Africa are not rich, but they weren't rich in Europe. Now, we used to just get one ton of hectare, we get 10 tons of hectare. I'm not saying Africa is ever going to get 10 tons, but they must be able to get half a ton. And it's quite likely to be able to get 2 tons. And you can see that there 2 tons from the same rainfall as you did compared to half a ton, there has been an extraordinary increase in productivity. So, amplify or extend it, one of the questions to try to indicate the importance of the whole range of water resources which are normally good.
My name is Kathy Welle. Until last week I worked for the Overseas Development Institute, the Water Policy Programme. Since this week I'm a PhD student at the University of Sussex. My question is to Tony. Alan has just presented his view of Hesoptimism. Hesoptimism. So small water, Ethiopian perspective. And now I'm interested, Tony, what is your take? Hydro-optimist, hydro-pessimist, from the perspective of the water and
Africa? I'm obviously an opti-pessimist. Some years ago I coined the phrase optimists are right, but dangerous pessimists are wrong, but useful. In pessimists, they can be worried and they can bring about a change of behavior. Optimists cause people to relax into not facing the problem. So I feel that on the basis of underlying fundamentals, that is, the soil and water resources of Africa and the potential of its people, rule-making capacity and organizations, it could meet not only the present but also the future challenges. But in order to get the resources combined and political economies that work wonders, the signs are not good at the moment. Being endowed with water is not really very important. If you think Singapore, it only has 5% of the water it needs. It only has half the water it needs for domestic and industrial purposes. It has no water or scarcely any for domestic crops at all. So it has to import all its food and half the water it needs for domestic and industrial purposes. And yes, it is one of the top economies in the world. So shortage of water determines nothing if you're going to get yourself out of it. We can, three of us, these are the houses in the Thames Basin, I live in the Thames Basin, and it occasionally comes to the Thames Basin. And we have 17.5 million people, and far too many. And we have the Thames Basin, which has got enough water for about 2 million people. No one talks about the resources, except occasionally there's a driver's road or something. So it is totally to do with how you get your politics organized, and if you have politics organized, you can organize an economy which copes with the problem. So I have to be an optimist, because I'm sure that Africa can achieve it.
Thank you. My name is Daniel Gurenga. I'm with the Center for Chinese Studies in South Africa. My question is for Alan Nicole. Basically, as you might well know, in Ethiopia you have central government and the federal system, which has been running into trouble with some of the regions, namely the Ugandan region. My question is, to what extent the party cadres that are usually sent to the federal regions, to what extent the waters play a part in the conflict and the tensions between central government and the Ugandan region?
Yeah, that's a question I can't really answer very well, but I can conjecture. An opinion is as good as an answer. The situation goes way beyond water in Yogadé. Generally speaking, the water issues would be entirely subsumed by the issues of security, of political violence, of repression, etc., etc. How far the water issue actually informs the cadres and how they interact with regional authorities? Well, I don't know. I don't know, and it's very difficult to find out because the political economy in Ethiopia is very deeply above or below many layers of very informal politics that aren't easy to unpack or to get a picture. I know for a fact that region has a water scarcity problem. I've been there many times. I know there are water markets. I know there are problems of access to surface water through the burfields, the tanks that they build there, the water tanks, that is. And the issues are probably alive, and there are problems of water conflict in that region, but they really are subsumed by the bigger issue of the nation and nationalism and autonomy or the ONLF, and I don't know how it plays out locally, but I imagine it's really not that important. More important is the chat trade, the trade in the leaves and uncutted leaves that people have to chew. But I'm happy to discuss it in private afterwards. Tricky question. it's a very tricky question, but it's, you know, it goes to the heart of this political economy issue, and it is something that we're trying to understand a bit better, not through the Ripple program, but outside the Ripple program, to understand, you know, where is the political system affecting the decision making on resource allocation. Because a lot of it is buried deep in political economies that you don't really understand unless something happens, like someone gets sacked from their role as head of the Water Bureau, or, you know, the minister changes his closest advisors. You know, it's a bit like the old Soviet bloc, people watching who was standing at the parade next to Brezhnev. It's that kind of thing. A little bit, not that.
Well, Carlos Gabrielo from the University of Porto, about Ethiopia, some financial aspects. Who finances the investment on infrastructures? Who is the owner of the funds? Are there loans? How is the return on investment? How are the payments then? Who is the owner, or who are the owners of the infrastructures? In this question, the origin of the funds is very important. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Well, the funding in Ethiopia is quite diverse.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not a simple donor-led environment. There's a lot of public money that goes into the provision of water in Ethiopia. There also there's foreign direct investment in the sector, but a lot of money comes through different channels, government channels, aid funding. DFID's recently announced £75 million, about $140 million over 5 years. There is money there. There's money going into the sector, and the sector is not awash with funds, but there's plenty of money to invest in the water sector and in sanitation. But the problem is, as I touched on, it's the absorptive capacity of the government. It's the systems of procurement, the alignment of different systems of procurement by different donors and donor programs, that affect the way money is dispersed and how soon it becomes a new service on the ground. And at the moment, there's an inordinate delay. The DFID funding, for instance, was announced about a year and a half ago, but none of it has been dispersed to local authorities yet. So the process of procurement, the process of funding through government channels is very slow, and that leads to dissatisfaction, and then this issue of downward accountability I was mentioning. It's critically important. There isn't, at the moment, a link between whether or not services are delivered as promised and the kind of calls made on government, the kind of political noise you hear at the local level. Because the political structure and the political economy in Ethiopia doesn't, quote-unquote, encourage that kind of relationship between the citizens and the government. So there isn't a dynamic, there isn't the media pushing for accountability, saying, why hasn't this money been spent? So the money does come from diverse sources, the ADB, the World Bank, the federal budget itself, from NGOs as well. And this is a big issue at the moment, because a lot of NGOs are working in the water sector, at least 30 international NGOs. But the government is now trying to squeeze the civil society part of that governance framework in a new law that they're trying to enact, or trying to pass through. So there are, you know, there's change in the kind of environment of service delivery at the moment, and people are concerned about where funding will come from for society to continue to provide sources. So in a nutshell, the financing is quite diverse, but the major problem is translating financing into service delivery. I'm happy to give you figures if you want figures afterwards.
Questions? Maybe to be
one to be more maximum. Direct, personal values. No more questions? So, Susanna, what do you want to say about the organization of the panels?
Yes, I think we should also discuss this in the chair to be writing some ideas on pessimism or vice versa. I think maybe we really have a session where we should have some kind of list of opportunities and challenges and maybe some lobbying issues or some more major concerns about the experiences that may be related in several sessions. I think we won't have really conclusions about anything, but maybe clarifying some of our concerns. And this is the beginning of the process, as you said. So we are trying to discuss in these several sessions and working with these main issues, exactly putting these ideas on the final session. What are major concerns? There are some opportunities and major difficulties in the experiences. So for the chairpersons in the sessions, there is not a rigid guideline for this, but in the end we will have to present to our participants all these summaries of the sessions. So it's very concise and short for ideas.
So this message was directly for the chair's discussions of the panel. But because I already know that some of you will not be here, for example, Daniela will not be here in the last day, and also some other people, so I will ask someone from that panel, one of the speakers that will be there. So you can decide among yourself. So I think that's it. We will have a coffee break, so we have more time to share ideas. And thank you very much for your presence.
The first parallel session on the whole issue of trans value laws and politics. I have been aware of trans value laws and politics for many decades since I worked in the Middle East, and the Middle East is famous for its conflicts over water. I spotted that although there is conflict over water, and everyone's very aware of the inadequacy of the rules there for sharing, that people have not gone to war over water. It's rather conflict over water in the Middle East, despite the numbers, despite the pure pessimism about it, despite entering into a serious water deficit about 1970 in the whole region and some areas before that. Already very water short, and there was still no war. So I had to explain that, and of course I found that the explanation of the international political economy was, since most of the economy is used to raise food, we can import food and therefore solve our problems with humanitarian issues, which is the Singapore and any other countries desperately short of water. However, in Africa, the options to solve water in that way are not yet great. South Africa has a major international trade over the year, and some of the African countries do export most of its important energy food commodities to some of the U.S. Kenya and Uganda are big exporters of most of the tea. But generally, the engagement of Africa in the global water trade is not great, or the global food trade, or the global virtual water trade is not great. So this morning we're going to be talking about the African river basins, and we've got something from one of the people in the southern African rivers, we've got something from the Senegal basin, and we've got something from the Nile basin, all very different, institutionally, and we're going to find that knowing the numbers is important, which we're going to find in the first presentation, because we're going to tend to find in the rest of the discussion that it's in the political domain, and the secret political domain, not the open, easily accessed relatively easy access numbers that we are interested in science, but in a completely closed, secret mode, but the transboundary water relations are